Proposed impeachment motion. Gravely concerned that the president has become the country's source of instability by his indiscriminate and continuous dismissal of members of his cabinet. Further worried that there has been no meaningful development in the country in the past 10 years, resulting in an unprecedented economic tailspin. Further concerned that the president has not taken any meaningful steps to stem endemic corruption, which has become the country's number one enemy, therefore calls upon this House to cause the removal of the president from office in light of the above, and that voting in the motion of no confidence in the president be by sacred ballot. Now that is the motion of impeachment which the Zimbabwean parliament will debate tomorrow if Robert Mugabe does not resign. But Peter de Toey and Adrian Besson, joint authors of Enemy of the People, I did leave some things out, but essentially it could be an impeachment motion which we could debate against Jacob Zuma.
Hello, John. Thanks for having us. Yeah, I was kind of intrigued for a minute where you got that from. Was it in our book? Was it in our parliament? Indeed, I think, President Jacob Zuma has had a disastrous term in office. He started off with some positive vibes. Thabo Mbeki was not, this last few years was not great. And I think we sometimes forget how bad Mbeki was at his end because just because of how disastrous Zuma has been. But it hasn't been a fun 10 years. We're in a bad spot as a country, The ANC is in a very bad spot of bother. The economy is not growing. Institutions have been wrecked. And I think that's probably what the most important story I wanted to tell in this book.
Enemy of the people. Is that not an overstatement? A poor president. Enemy of the people? Is that not a bit melodramatic?
No, it's not, John. I think we try to build the argument in the book that President Jacob Zuma, when he came into power in 2009, like Adrian mentioned, it was off the back of Thabo Mbeki's last couple of years, which were pretty fraught as well. And he actually came into office, yes, with a cloud of corruption hanging over his head. But he did come into office with a degree of goodwill, if not from the people, but definitely from the governing alliance. And he used that goodwill and he used the power that he had to enrich himself, to ensconce his own position in state and government, to prevent him from going to jail. That was in essence what he wanted to do. The state capture project picked up steam in 2012, 2014 when he won re-election, when the ANC won the election by a margin of 64%. And from then on, it picked up steam. So we would argue that he is the enemy of the people. The way that he repurposed the state, the way in which he diverted resources that should have gone to normal South Africans makes him enemy number one, we would argue.
There are many great values to the book, but I would argue one of the great values is that it puts it all together. Pravin Gordhan has said plenty of times, join the dots. And that's what you do, Adrian and Peter, in this book. You join the dots. And in a way, a 15, 20-minute conversation like this one does the book a disservice because inevitably we are only going to concentrate on certain elements. And it is, as you read it from page 1 to page 330-odd, that you go, wow, really? All of that?
Well, Adrian can come in, but when we researched the book, we were very lucky in the sense that we were able to observe the ascent of Jacob Zuma from 2005 when he was released from his duties by then President Thabo Mbeki up until now. So we were privileged as journalists to have the front row seats to this. But South Africans and even us as journalists, you get bombarded with all these dramas, all these scandals, all these events. That it's sometimes difficult to sit back and try to connect the dots as Pravin Gordhan implored us to do. Now, one of the things that, myself as a working full-time journalist, which shocked me was the extent to which you forget some of these scandals.
I had exactly that same experience reading the book. Well, of course, yes, that happened too.
I mean, the fact that he survived in Kandla is quite remarkable. I mean, the fact that he survived the judgment by the Constitutional Court in March last year, it's shocking. When you read it again, it's shocking and it shocks you anew. So yes, I think to connect the dots, to see the story in its full. There is value in that.
I think just to add to your question, that's exactly what we try to do. And thank you for the compliment, because, you know, it was for us important as two journalists who's still in the field every day, who's sitting in digital newsrooms, which are very hungry and which we feed, you know, with breaking news the whole time, to just take a step back for a moment and observe the past 10 years of Zuma's tenure and look at those very early promises he made to the communists and the workers, you know, who were by his side, and the youth, the ANC Youth League, Julius Malema, Zwelinzima Mavavi, Blaise Nzimande, where he's fierce backers right in the beginning, they all turned against him massively in a big way. And just to track, how did this happen? Why did it happen? What did they actually expect of him? Why didn't he perform? And who's now by his side? How did he manage to capture the state? Because, John, I mean, we can talk about this a bit, but state capture, I think, is often misunderstood by a lot of people. It is quite a new term in our lexicon. But you know, if you look at the story from the start, he had to capture the ANC first, and then state institutions before he could bring in his son and the Guptas. And to realize that almost through the writing process was, for me, an eye-opener as well.
Is there a sense that one sin is more egregious than another, that the worst thing he's done is the weakening of the treasury and SARS? The worst thing he's done is the stacking of the boards of the state-owned enterprises in order to make them, you know, easy hunting ground for the patronage faction, you know, the firing of the finance minister. Is there a sense of a scale of wrongdoing?
You would have thought that, wouldn't you? I mean, I think if we cast our minds back to that fateful evening in December 2015 when he decided to replace Nhlanhla Nene as Minister of Finance with an unknown ANC backbencher, we all thought, you know, this might be the tipping point. Or it would be the Constitutional Court's judgment, or from the ANC's perspective, losing three more metros, you know, that might tip the scales. Nothing did. He even went on to fire Pravin Gordhan, and really, he did go on to capture Treasury. You know, we thought, you know, that might be the tipping point for someone to stand up, someone in the ANC to say, up until this point and no more. But it never came, you know. So it's difficult to say which sin is more egregious than the next, because I think all of them are pretty bad. But he's been ruling with impunity ever since he took the oath of office in 2009.
Look, I think Peter and I might actually differ on this one, because he's very passionate about Treasury and the finance departments that were gutted by the Zuma administration. Where my obsession has always been the criminal justice sector and how those institutions have been destroyed. But I think ultimately where we will agree on, the point we try to make, is the institutions of democracy.
They're all institutions.
That's been eroded.
The Public Protector, the most recent of them.
Absolutely. Which Tuli Madonsela built up to a sterling institution over how many years? SARS, you know, South African Revenue Service. I still can't believe, sometimes it feels like waking up in the middle of a nightmare when I think of what's going on at SARS and wanting to believe that is not true, because this was truly an internationally acclaimed tax revenue service being gutted. We hear now that 50 billion rand will not be raised. There's no more investigative capacity in SARS. If you read Jock Post's book, you know, just the level to which SARS has protected this president and his keepers. So it's all out there for everyone to see. And in the long run, I do think it will cost Jacob Zuma, and specifically the ANC.
So you both believe it's clear that this was a plan. It wasn't stuff that happened taking decisions on the hoof, as it were, that he went in with a plan. In order for me to be able to stay in power, these are the things I need to do. These are the institutions that I need to stack with my own people so that an independent-minded person in that institution doesn't stand in my way.
I think it was a combination of staying out of prison, as Peter has said, and making as much money as possible for him and his family and the people who fund his lifestyle. I mean, John, you'll remember from the Sheikh trial, which I covered from beginning to end, is that, you know, the one thing that was clear from the Shabir Sheikh trial was that Zuma is in absolutely no position to fund his lifestyle expenses, his ever-growing family, you know, his children, his wives, many wives, and then Nkandla developments. He needed extra cash. Now, with Nkandla, we knew the state basically gave him that extra cash to sponsor the entire development. And in the book, we go back to how it's still not clear who paid for the houses, and that there's strong suspicion that it was actually cross-subsidized through the Department of Public Works. But he had to get new sheikhs after Shabir went to prison. And, you know, I would argue that the Guptas became the new sheikhs. It was just a bit more sophisticated this time.
You make the point in the book that he learned from the Shabir Sheikh matter, where monies were deposited directly into his account. And you really would struggle to find money into his account, because he has had all of these proxies who've been taking the largesse on his behalf.
Yeah, I think that's true, and but this is just another level. This is like a real different scale of corruption, and it was differently done. It was through bringing in Dudizane Zuma as the representative, almost of the Zuma incorporated into this Zupta empire, which needed state entities opened, which needed protection from prosecution and investigation, and that's where it connects, and that's where I would agree with you that there was a grand plan to ultimately protect the family and their funders from prosecution, but also for them to thrive in this state economy.
It's very instructive to go back to 2009, 10, 11, 12, the first couple of years of Zuma's tenure as head of state, to see how we covered him, how we judged Zuma, how we thought this presidency will play out. Remember, he did come into office with a cloud of corruption over his head, but we all thought, look, he will have to operate within the bounds of the constitutional and statutory framework and conventional the conventions of governance that has been established ever since 1994. But he did start with a long plan. He did start with a plan which I would argue that a lot of people did not identify and see in the beginning. He was never going to be bound by convention, constitution, or law. He was always going to use his position, his office, to advance his own interests, and that's what he did with a remarkable degree of success and enormous discipline. Actually, the state capture project is now coming to serious fruition. Obviously, it's being torn asunder at the moment. But
yeah,
what he did
and
do
how
was
the people fought back. We must talk about that as well. Yeah. I mean, just one paragraph. Page 116, How to Hijack a Mine. To recap, the Guptas wanted a coal mine. Molefe and Gubani used their power to squeeze Optima under Glencore into business rescue. Ramaklodi refused to shut down all Glencore's mines. Tony Gupta sent Zwane CV to Dudizane Zuma. Jacob Zuma appointed Zwane as mining minister. Zwane traveled to Zurich with the Guptas to persuade Glencore to sell them their coal mine. Zwane flew back with the Guptas on their private jet. The Guptas got a coal mine. There's one paragraph that sums up the entire way of operating.
And that state capture for you, John. I mean, in that chapter, we try to take one example because these things are so overwhelming. I mean, even for us working in the newsroom where the Gupta leaks were exposed, in partnership with Amabungani and Daily Maverick, sitting there and reading all these thousands of emails is completely overwhelming. So, but just taking that one example of literally the state being used to squeeze Glencore to sell their mine to the Guptas, while another BE company was standing knocking on the door trying to get this mine at a higher price.
With their own money, not needing Eskom to pay them up front.
Absolutely.
It's staggering to have it laid out page after page after page after page. And you end up asking yourself how it is that this country, with a proud tradition of resistance from, all right, we had a period in the 50s, but then it quietened down, and then 76 it started up again, through the 80s, 90s, UDF, all of that, with that proud tradition of standing up for what is right. How is it that we've allowed this man to do to this country what he has?
Well, I think Adrian hit the nail on the head earlier, because he had to capture the ANC first, and that started in 2006, 2007, and culminated at Polokwane. Now, it's been a decade since the putsch of Polokwane, where Jacob Zuma engineered the takeover of the ANC. And if you look at the ANC's history since 2007, if you look at the elections, if you look at the NEC that has been elected, if you look what they've done ever since 2007, they've been unable to resist Jacob Zuma. They've been unable to stake a stand against Jacob Zuma. And again, my most instructive example is after Pravin Gordhan was sacked. On the Friday morning, Gwede Mantashe was on your sister station, 702 in Joburg. And Gwede Mantashe was at an absolute loss of words. He just could not explain why the president decided to fire Pravin Gordhan. That afternoon, Cyril Ramaphosa said the same thing. The following day, Zweli Mkhize said the same thing. And on Monday, they were forced to apologize, and they were forced to repudiate their own public pronouncement. So he captured the ANC. That's how he did it. The ANC still in this country has the very strong and very valuable reputation of being the Party of Liberation. It took a long time for South Africans to question the ANC and question their motives. Jacob Zuma has now made it very clear that the ANC is a party that doesn't stand above scrutiny.
The second part of the subtitle reads, How Jacob Zuma Stole South Africa, and that's what we've been talking about, and how the people fought back. Mm. It's my contention always when I am asked whether there is any hope for this country. I say we have three things going for us, which we must not underestimate the strength of. active civil society, which has become considerably more active in the last few years as a result of what Zuma has been doing to the country, an independent judiciary and free media. But you have to wonder how successful that fight back is being. He giggles his way through answering questions in the National Council of Provinces. He does so regularly in the House of Assembly. He seems to believe that he has done no wrong. In a world which operated in any way logically, his proxy wouldn't stand a chance at Nasrec on the 16th of December. And yet we face the prospect in 3.5 weeks' time of finding out that yet another battle has been won by Zuma.
Look, John, I agree with you. I think that, you know, the fight back could have been better, but I don't think one should underestimate what we've seen in the past few years. You know, it's now very common for the CEO of Business Leadership South Africa to stand up on any platform and say that Zuma is a crook. I mean, that happened 2 weeks ago at a press conference that I attended. For big business in South Africa to stand up to say Zuma must go. For thousands, literally thousands of South Africans taking to the streets in April and May this year, after Gordon was fired, to say Zuma must go, Zuma must fall. The election last year, we shouldn't underestimate the historic impact and the historic result we had in specifically Johannesburg and Tshwane. In Port Elizabeth, it's been coming for a while. But to lose Johannesburg and Tshwane, the capital of this country, to a DA-EFF coalition was massive. It was massive, and it was a writing on the wall for the ANC. In fact, that's how we start our book in the prologue of that night at the election center, where we saw, you know, these sad figures of Gwede Mantas, Jesse Duarte, and Zweli Mkhize standing
faces.
There. You know, seeing the results come in. And I would say, I would argue that that is the culmination of the fight back, that ultimately the ANC can no longer get away with spin, with PR, with trying to blame everyone else besides themselves. You know, this elective conference that's coming up has the potential to rip the ANC apart, has the potential to lead to a split in the party. You know, if either of the candidates win or lose, I can absolutely not see unity between the Zuma and the Ramaphosa camps. So I think this is in a way also the end of the ANC.
What we can see is the conference not happening and Zuma continuing to rule. You know, I mean, it's quite clear that he will stop at nothing. He will abridge the South African constitution, the ANC constitution. Your book, Enemy of the People, Jacques' book, The President's Keepers, Crispin Olver's wonderful book, How to Steal the City, which does, in microcosm, focus on what the macro is allowed for by Zuma being the enemy of the people. Ronnie Casserole's book, Ray Hartley's book about Cyril Ramaphosa, Karim du Plessis' book about Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma. There's an enormous amount of information out there which, to an objective reader, would suggest that Zuma is a cancerous growth that needs to be removed. Do you think it makes any difference, all of these books?
Absolutely. I think knowledge is power, isn't it, John? I think the more people understand about what's going on around them, the better informed decisions they can make. And Andre had mentioned last year's municipal elections. That was a massive turning point. And it also showed that South Africans, they won't sit on their hands and wait for things to happen. You know, another point that I would add to show where our society does work is the fact that we are allowed in this country to write a book with this title. We are allowed to go onto the SSBC last week like we did to talk about the problems that President Jacob Zuma's leadership and presidency caused South Africa and ordinary South Africans. So we have freedoms to explain what the issues are and what South Africans can do about it. We still have an independent judiciary which has played a massive role over the last couple of years to roll back some of the excesses of government, whether it be the nuclear deal, whether it is the payment of social grants. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's still going for us. I don't think South Africans should get too despondent, but we are in a pickle, more than a pickle. We're in a very serious situation. Come the morning of the 21st of December, we will be living in a different country. If Ramaphosa wins, the ANC will go in a different direction. If Dlamini Zuma wins, you know, we know where that will go.
We're not in a pickle. We're in a full-blown vindaloo curry. That's what we are. So we have a couple of listeners in the audience with us. One of them wants to ask a question.
Hi, my name is... It's Mpo Rampal. I just want to know, in your own investigation, because I haven't read a lot in the book, do you think that Jacob Zuma had a clear plan to capture the state before he became the leader? And if that's the case, was the disbanding of Scorpion part of that plan to replace it with the Toothless Hawks?
Mpo, absolutely. I think that the disbandment of the Scorpions was almost the first thing that happened post Polokwane to help the Zupta faction to put their claws into the state coffers. The Scorpions was an absolutely magnificent, internationally renowned and awarded a corruption busting agency. We've never replaced that organization. The Hawks is not by far what the Scorpions could do. They don't have the same skills. So yes, we're seeing really a pathetic amount of investigations coming out of the police these days. There's been one politician, John Block in the Northern Cape, who kind of saw himself being convicted, but no one else. So I definitely think the Scorpions was almost first on the menu when Zuma came into power for destruction.
Another question. We have to start wrapping up fairly soon.
Speaking here. Now, with all the books that have been written about this thing, isn't it not working in Zuma's favor, the fact that almost all the books are written by people who are different from the people?
Who are white, I mean, let's say. Yes. It was the question I was going to go to.
Yes.
All the books that I mentioned are written by white people.
And probably isn't the reason why there is no support, for instance, because there's this tag about the clever blacks. So black people have been subdued, so to speak. And then there comes the white people now writing about him. So there's nothing that can be believed about.
There are books written by black people, just as Malala's, Descent and so on. There are books, and there are crossing columns written by black people as well, which are as critical, if not more so, than you are in this book.
I think that Reddit Lobby's book on queers is probably the most heart-hitting of all the books that's come out this season. If you read the details about what happened to Kwesi and what she had to go through,
it shouldn't matter. I don't think our race should matter at all. We're working journalists. We were in the position that we could observe his presidency from up close since 2005. Like I said, it was an opportunity to write an historical document to put this into perspective. So I hope race doesn't cloud it. It shouldn't.
I also want to just say that people who think that we wrote the book to influence the ANC conference is maybe overestimating our influence slightly.
but it is a very powerful summation of Zuma's plan from A to where we are now with Z for Zuma, and let's hope it's G for gone very, very soon. Adrien Besson, Peter du Toit, folks, buy the book, read it, arm yourself with the knowledge that Peter talked about. It's called Enemy of the People, and thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you, John. Thanks, John.